Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. And I'm totally and utterly surrounded by the Grog Squad. Yes, we're coming live from the heart of Manchester, the greatest city in the world, from Fanboy 3. Take the scouse right, please. And we're delighted to invite Chris McDowell to speak to us today, and I'm going to ask questions at the end. Is that all right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, but the first thing I need to do, here in my left, I've got the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Monroe. Would you like to give it a tap?
I'm genuinely, this is the most excited moment of my life. Absolutely.
Okay. Ooh. So there she's constructed from Stella Star, from Carla, and Doug McClure's legs. Just a moment. We used that one last year. That's odd. Well, that's good, because we're going into the odd. Yeah. So, yeah, Chris, you're known for Into the Odd, and we'll get into that in a moment, but the first thing we always ask is, how did you start playing? So how did you get to role-playing games?
So my introduction to, well, tabletop games as a whole was from a very intimidating figure, which was a boy from the year above at school.
Oh, yeah.
And this was when I was about 9, 10 years old, but if I try and picture it now, I still picture like a giant... Like the way that an 11-year-old boy would look to a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this great authority. And he was like one of the cooler kids in the year above. And we had like a show and tell sort of thing. And he brought in all of his Warhammer figures and White Dwarf magazines. And I grew up in a very small town in Staffordshire where I was loosely aware of D&D as a thing, mm-hmm. from the cartoon as much as anything else. But this was my first kind of exposure to the idea of like tabletop games. Yeah. And yeah, from there, me and a friend who were both very wowed by this display sort of got into the Warhammer stuff sort of quite heavily and started playing, you know, the miniature games and all that. And then a couple of years later, we were at they used to do the Games Day Expo at the NEC, the big kind of annual games workshop sort of convention, I guess. And there was a little tiny table in the corner of the underground section of the convention hall, as I remember it, where there was Hogshead Publishing table.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Where they had some copies of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, which I'd never seen in a Games Workshop. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen in a White Dwarf. So I thought, is this something someone's just made? Is this like a knockoff bootleg game? And then I started sort of paging through it. And I didn't understand what I was looking at, because I was like, I recognize some of these things from Warhammer, but there's a lot more tables, a lot more about characters, and it seems so obvious now, but at the time I sort of thought, well, this sounds interesting. It must be kind of like Warhammer Quest or Hero Quest or like a board game like that. So we bought a book, and then my friend and I tried to play it, and tried is the key word, because we kind of didn't really know what an RPG is. And as much as I still have a lot of love for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, this was the first edition, and I feel like going in cold to that is quite a jump.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily what I would call a good intro game to go in completely cold without somebody who knows how to play or run an RPG. But that kind of was the spark. And then from there, I kind of, over the years, sort of dabbled with other systems and sort of discovered sort of D&D, but then sort of hit my stride when I discovered sort of what's going on with sort of the OSR and like the old school revival or renaissance or whatever. And these games that kind of take what I sort of wanted and imagined Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay to be, and but made it a little bit more something I could actually digest.
Yes.
And by that point, I'd learned a little bit along the way as well myself, so I wasn't going in quite as blindly as I was as a child. But yeah, and then, I mean, I'm just going to keep going until I talk about how I got here today, if you want. I feel like I need to stop.
But just take you back on that Warhammer. So was it the fantasy or the 4K?
Well, I remember we really got into like looking through the White Dwarfs and stuff, but there wasn't a Games Workshop near us. And to this day, I've still got a lot of affection for Merry Hill Shopping Centre in Dudley, because that was the closest Games Workshop. And I think my mum and dad must have said, like, okay, well, if you want to go, we'll drive you there in like 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And it felt like an eternity. I remember waiting and thinking, oh, I'm going to get to go to a Games Workshop and talk to one of these experts in a register. It's probably one of these lot. I mean, people I've spoken to this weekend, everyone works there at some point, I think, when I was growing up. And then we went in, and I remember the guy coming over to me in the Games Workshop and saying, so, what's cooler, swords or guns?
Right.
And I think, I said swords. And he was like, you want fantasy? And that was how I was assigned my game.
Yeah.
And I kind of stand by it, but like I feel like I was perhaps robbed slightly of enjoying the 40K side of things, because I felt like I was on a team then.
Yes.
And for a while I was like, I don't want to know about that 40K. I'm on team fantasy. The fantasy stuff was sort of my first...
You can imagine them workshopping that, can't you? Out of Games Workshop.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Where, you know, bride or groom is approach.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So what aspect of it, was it the gaming aspect of it, or did you collect the miniatures and paint them?
Well, I remember even when, thinking back to when I first, you know, at that show and tell day at my school, I remember he had some miniatures, but weirdly it was like it was almost the idea of it more than the actual practicalities of buying and painting miniatures and playing this game that was kind of clunky. Again, I've got a lot of affection for it, but it's kind of a clunky game, especially the old edition that I was playing. We did used to paint very badly. We did used to play, but it was always more the idea of this world that exists that appealed to me. And so it seems like it'd be a natural fit to go into the RPG side of things. But it took me a few years to even discover that side existed.
Yeah.
It's the idea of this world that exists outside of everything else and is kind of something you've got to buy a magazine to learn about, and the kind of slightly esoteric secret nature of it was always quite
tantalising,
I think.
Yeah, yeah. Good. And who were you playing with at this time?
So at the moment, a friend of mine who's still, you know, my best friend after these years, we used to play in my cellar. We had a very small cellar, and my dad somehow ended up getting a pool table from a pub that was closing down. And around the pool table, if you imagine a pool table, the walls of the cellar are about maybe a foot and a half bigger than the pool table. So you couldn't really actually play pool on it. So it became the Warhammer table. We used to play in the cellar. But we did used to play the big Warhammer battles. But things like the Warhammer Quest, which was kind of the dungeon crawling board game, and the Hero Quest, weirdly, even though that was kind of the simpler version, those were the ones that sort of really got into at that stage.
Yeah. So have you ever deviated from fantasy, or have you kind of stuck with that?
Yeah, so over the years, I did eventually sort of dip into Warhammer 40K sort of after I realised I don't need this guy in a red shirt to tell me which game I can and can't play. But especially things like Necromunda, the skirmish game, and like Gork and Morka, those smaller games that were coming out that were a bit more focused. Played a lot of them. And I think... yeah, there's a lot of really interesting room to explore that setting in little games like that.
Yeah.
So I got into those more as I got older. And then when I sort of hit at a certain point in the teenage development where you think, well, I should be cooler than this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try and be cool for a bit. So you put all that stuff away. But the RPGs kind of took over then. I don't know if that is cooler than miniatures. But it's easier to hide the miniatures. I think that's the thing. It's easier to hide a D20 than it is a giant Skaven army.
Yeah.
That was kind of when I sort of shifted then to the RPG side of things.
Yeah. And in RPGs, so give us an idea of what kind of things you were playing.
So, we tried to play Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay a few times, and it never really stuck. Mm-hmm. I loved reading the book, and I loved looking through it and looking at all these the backgrounds you could be, and all the different critical hit tables, and all this stuff that was like made it feel like it was almost like a simulation is kind of a dirty word in RPGs, I think. Not so much a simulation in the sense that it's...
Not in here, is
accurate. But simulation in the sense that it feels like it's a real world that exists in this book, kind of separate to the players.
Yeah.
So if a critical hit happens and it's a really nasty one, it's because the book has deemed it so. That always appealed to me. But then I found that was all just a little... It never quite stuck for me, the actual rules of one fantasy roleplay. So I naturally... being very thrifty, went online and looked for free RPGs. So for a while, I just played a lot of things that people were just making and sticking up on websites, sort of various things like Microlight 20, and lots of just free games that were on like someone's really bad 90s GeoCity website. I remember I would read a lot of them and think, this is the real stuff that's happening. This is the real great game design.
Right.
But then the one that stuck with me after a while was there's a game called Searchers of the Unknown.
Oh, I don't know.
Which
so,
is a,
so what was that?
So it's a one-page... attempt. It's an attempt to make a one-page version of like either basic D&D or original D&D.
Mm-hmm.
And the conceit is that if a monster can be statted out as their move score, their AC, their damage, and their save score, I think, then what if the player characters were the same? So your player characters just get the same little stat block as a monster, and everything else fits on one page, and there's a very simple set of sort of conflict rules around it. And it on the page, it doesn't look like much, but then when I actually tried playing it, what happened was really fun because when you haven't got that much to work with on the paper, the players kind of get more creative. And I just remember things like we were like chopping down doors to like build bridges, and we were setting up all sorts of traps for the monsters because you can't, there's not that much fun stuff you can do with your character, like just based on the paper. So you have to kind of really engage with the world.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what set off the spark for me of enjoying this kind of really stripped back approach where you kind of put more of the focus on the world and creating things you can do in the world rather than having lots of rules.
A Games Master prepares.
Welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Derek.
It's unusual this is a phone call we're doing, isn't it? We're not doing it the normal way. We just thought we'd do this the morning after, the weekend before.
Well, it's fresh in our minds.
How does it feel waking up today and not having to go hunting for breakfast?
Yeah, we did have, there was a bit of a breakfast crisis in Manchester, wasn't there? Hunting for bread in one place. We went and didn't get breakfast until the man with the bread, the artisan bread, had arrived.
That's the thing, isn't it? You know, in previous years, like up to a couple of years ago, what we did is we got hotel breakfast, didn't we? But we decided that Manchester, the hipster centre of the Northern Quarter, is so full of places. Why don't we go there? And I think what's happened is Manchester's got back on its feet, hasn't it, after a year of hospitality being under the cosh. And it was busy. We just found it really hard to get somewhere to have a breakfast.
Well, we did that classic thing that last time. As you say, we stayed in a hotel and it was one of those dreadful buffet breakfasts. So the first morning, we queued up for the dreadful buffet breakfast and thought, this is dreadful. The following morning, we thought, let's just go into Manchester. And went into Manchester and it was full of places that were nice breakfast. And we thought, let's do this. This is fantastic. And it's almost like this year, everyone else had the same idea. I don't mean grog meat people. I just mean everybody else who's in a hotel in Manchester thought, These big buffet breakfast things in hotels are rubbish. Let's go and have a nice artisan breakfast. All had the same idea.
Let's have something on a sourdough.
Everything's
avocado with it. Everything's got an avocado with it as well, haven't
they? Well, what they've got, it's always got sourdough. It's always got an avocado on it somewhere. They always try and slip an avocado in. And it's also always got something that you're not quite sure what it is. It's usually like cheese, like that posh beans on toast thing had something called Grand Moravia. It sounds like somewhere a vampire might live. Moravia. I didn't like to ask what's that. It was cheese. It was a bit of cheese. It must be a type of cheese. But there's always something that describes what you get, and it'll mention sourdough, it'll mention avocado, and it will mention other things that you do know, but it will also mention something that you don't know what it is, and you don't know whether to ask. You don't know whether to ask or not.
The thing with sourdough is, you know, I'm not sure where I stand on it because I feel like I like it, but it is hard work, isn't it? It feels like it feels like you're having a good time, But it is hard work, you know. It's a bit. You have to work at it, don't you?
It's true that toasted sourdough. You have to get hammer and chisel on it, don't you? This is nice, but God,
it's a bit like Rollmaster or something like that. I don't know. you're working hard at it.
It's probably better for you. Is it better for you? I don't know. No, I'm assuming it's better for you because it's so popular, but that may not be the case. I don't know enough about these things.
And the whole thing of Manchester coming back to life and being a bit busier, and I think it was the last Premiership match before the World Cup. Yeah. So it was really busy, wasn't it, in Manchester on the Saturday. Everybody got dispersed. I think at one point we found ourselves drinking in a back street that a bouncer had said, "I'll tell you where you can go." And he led us, didn't he, down? Because everywhere was full.
It wasn't so much that they were full, was it? It was the fact that all the pubs that are normally kind of craft beer, and that's another aspect, sorry, don't we? That's another story. We won't get into that. But everywhere that's kind of craft beer bar, places that we would go to on a GABO, which are all right, suddenly become full of younger people. And they all have a DJ on. They all have a DJ on, don't they? Everywhere we went had a DJ. It's dance music banging out. But no one was dancing. And the only person who seemed to be enjoying themselves was the DJ.
Yes.
And whilst as a bunch of people of a certain age, none of us, the Grog Squad, really liked. None of us liked it. Apart from Abs. I remember Abs dancing around. He's the only person dancing in the place. But that's another story. But we don't like it. But I'm not sure any of the younger people seem to like it because none of them were dancing. And it was just like, what's this, the purpose of this? Why have you... I go in a nightclub. Not a nightclub and offer a dance or whatever, fair enough. You know, but what is the point of this DJ playing this dance music at absolutely, you know, turned up to 11. And even, you can't even look around and go, it's a generational thing, old man, because all these young people are really with it. They didn't look with it. They looked annoyed by it as well. So it's just something that happens and you have to tolerate it.
Yeah. So we were escorted, weren't we, into this back street area. So it was an exclusive club. And we realised that we were on top of a... manhole cover for a sewer, and every so often we get the waft of effluent.
And also, if it was a role-playing game, if a large bouncer in a tavern escorted you into a back street, you would never go, would you? You wouldn't go, would you? You'd think, what's this about? You'd just kill everyone in the room, wouldn't you, before you'd be escorted into the back alley.
It did look like an alleyway out of a comic strip, didn't it? Like somewhere where Bruce Wayne's parents would get killed. It was like fire ladders.
It did. As if they'd made it look like that kind of place. It wasn't naturally like that, but they made it. Yeah, it's a theme back alley.
like a film set.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we did
like a couple of hobbits talking about, right? Endlessly.
DD Miles.
Friday starts with the multi-table event. So we're going to do a bit of a Games Master Prepares and talk about the games that we did. So we probably need to set the scene for the multi-table event. Seven game masters.
Seven
tables. The idea was that it was Mega City 1 during Block Mania. Players would be playing perps who were taking advantage of the judges being distracted by everything that was going on to commit crimes. And each games master had their own encounter that they devised, and they rotated every half hour so that the players had six different encounters to enjoy.
Seven tables, but you only got six, didn't you? Because there were seven of us, but you only got six encounters in the time we had to do them.
Yeah. Yes, So it's a unique experience, I'd say, doing that with everybody playing the same game. We used the mothership rules because they were nice and easy. And
you've said that nice and easy. I might dispute that. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a moment. So what was your encounter, by the way? What did
my encounter? And it's pretty important to say as well, there was 10 points available for each encounter, wasn't there? So it was competitive that each block, each gang could win points on each encounter. And then they were all added up at the end and there was a dice roll made, wasn't there, to decide.
Yeah, to see who won the gang war, who was the best.
My encounter was at Stukey Glanders. So it was a rooftop Stukey Glanding farm where the judges attacked to stop the Stukey Glanders. And the Stukes, for those who don't know, the Stukeys are these passive aliens, aren't they, that the glands are harvested for their rejuvenating properties to make people look eternally young. They were Stukey Glanders, and basically they had to get their Stukeys to safety to score points. Each Stukey had a point. And also the judges had a new toxin called Stukey Stubber, that if they hit the Stukeys with it, the Stukeys became worthless. It neutralized their glandular powers and they became worthless. Apart from if they made a critical save, Stukey made a critical save, it became immune to Stukey Stubber. And then, is it a golden snitch in Harry Potter? It then became worth 10 points in its own right. And that did happen with a couple of saves, which was quite exciting, because as soon as that happened, that Stukey became the be-all and end-all because it was 10 points on its own. It was good fun. What was yours? Go on.
So mine was Beyonging. So if you know 2000 AD, you'll know that the miracle plastic boing has been invented, where you can spray it and it becomes spherical, turning you into a human pinball. And it's illegal to use it outside the Palais de Boeing. But these perps, for the duration of my table, had unlimited supply of Boeing so that they could jump from one block to the other. So it was Barry Elliott and Paul Elliott block, and they went to the top of one of them and bounced to the other and then bounced back again to me, to you, because, of course, it's the Chuckle Brothers, isn't it? And whereas the other games masters had come up with one encounter, it meant that I came up with 10 different encounters. So depending where you bounced into, you could get a different encounter. The higher you got, the more points were available. And if you wanted, you could use stress or spend stress to go a bit higher. I did it that way because I thought I'd get bored doing the same thing over and over. So I did it for my own amusement so that there was a bit of variety.
Well, we do these things for our own amusement anyway, don't we?
Exactly. But it was quite hard work coming up with 10 encounters.
I think it was one of those things, wasn't it? That it's the Grog Fringe, isn't it? So it's organised by Neil, by Old Scouts Rope. Playing, isn't it? It's like a little fringe event, and we all got together a few times to come up with our little encounters. And I think it's possible we might all be guilty of coming up with an idea and then thinking, yeah, that'll work, and then putting it, parking it somewhere for a few months until about maybe a month before Grog Meet, and then thinking, oh, I'll need to get knuckled down and sort this out now. When you actually start sorting it out, thinking, it's all right, okay. What if I said I'm doing here now? I've made something quite complicated for myself. So mine in my head was quite straightforward, but I realised that the way it worked was almost like a board game, and I would need a battle map, and I would need meeples, and I would need lots of things that I don't normally do. So I had to kind of look at doing that, and I felt suddenly a bit out of my comfort zone, because I thought, well, I don't normally do this kind of stuff, you know.
And let's face it, there is also a little bit of a competitive element between, because we've got all the different games masters. When you see somebody else using a battle mat and coming up with some models and stands, you start thinking, all right, that's the way it's going, is it? Right. Okay.
I need something. Yeah, you do. You think, I need something. I mean, Theatre of the Mind's fine, but everyone else has got stuff. I need stuff.
because people will be judging me as I go around that table.
and comparing. Yeah. Oh, well, we're all right.
I mean, this guy had like Lego figures, and he had some silly string, and he had a map, and he had meeples. But he said nothing. You know, theatre with him, and he's a bit lazy, isn't it? Yeah. Although I thought it was interesting. It's an interesting exercise because it highlighted to me, and I was talking to Steve Ray about this, Olanthi Vex. I talked to him about it, and he said the same, that it was exhausting because what he realized is when you run a game, there are peaks and troughs, as he put it, the peaks and troughs of energy as a games master. So there's bits where there's a fight and you go, right, I need to, you know, concentrate on what's happening and whose turn it is and all this kind of thing. And there's other bits of a scenario where there's players having a discussion for 10 minutes. And as a games master, you can sit back and go, they're deciding what to do. That's fine. I can relax. But with the Grog Fringe thing, because you move to a different table and you're running the same encounter, you were up top note all the time, weren't you?
Yeah.
It was like you had to do the bit I always hate about any game. You had to explain it. You had to sit down at a new table and they don't look at you and go, right, okay, I'm going to explain this very, very quickly. And of course, the players wanted it explained quickly because it was timed and there were points, so they didn't want too much explanation. Which, right, I'll go through all the explanation. Okay, what are you going to do? And it's like bang, 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 bang. And then that the timer went and you go, right, I've got to go to the next table. And right, here we go again. It's like starting a game from scratch almost, even though it was the same system. Your encounter felt like starting a game from scratch. And you realise how that is the most tiring bit of a game, that beginning bit of just getting everyone, drawing everyone into it and getting them on board. But then you had to do it six times. It was exhausting.
Yeah.
I think as we moved, we were all kind of bumping into each other and looking at each other going, I'm knackered. Oh.
We've done three
and I'm knackered. There's another three. Oh, what have we done? What have we done to ourselves?
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting for no other reason that it demonstrates where your energy is in a game, and you realize there's a lot of energy at the beginning of a game where you have to sit people down, go, right, this is what this is all about, and get them into it. And you had to do that six times. That was quite exhausting. Yeah.
And as you say, setting out, you know, where the points were, because that's what they were interested in. And with some of my encounters, because I did multiple ones, because they boined into a different level, some of the lower ones were designed to slow them down and distract them a bit. So, you know, one of them was a shopplex where there was a robot called Call Me Jamie. And he just... a bit of a waste of time, really. They had to make a meal, a Munchlin star meal using Munts for their boss, and they would get some advantages. But it took a while before they could get some points. And part of the way mine was that they had to make a decision. Do we stay in this or do we boing out of here? So they soon got to grips with that. But just setting up the premise of each of them, as you say, was difficult. And I did make one error. It's good because the way that it was set up, I actually only had the same scene only cropped up a couple of times. But one of the scenes was using footsies, people who had future shock, and they were going into coot cubes. They'd escaped from the coot cubes and they were running around. And I had some tables for their reaction whenever they were trying to be caught. Every time they were caught, they would get a point, put them into the coot cubes. And one of them was fire the silly string. And I'd made a can of boing, and it was actually a silly string, and fire it. And I managed to fire it into Arjun's mouth.
Health and safety issue.
It just blasted out. It was all over him. And it went pink as well. Fortunately, everybody signs a disclaimer before they... Pretty nasty stuff, that silly string.
Not so silly now, is it?
There you go. And we use Mothership because on the face of it, as I said, quite simple, isn't it? And we had this idea that we would be consistent at our table, which is all very
wrong. Consistently wrong. Yeah. So I think, we did agree that because there's a number of the discussions about certain rules that didn't seem particularly clear in the rule book. And therefore, we had to say, I may do this differently from the other Games Master, but I am doing it differently on every, I'm doing it the same, wrong or different, but the same way. I'm doing it wrongly the same way on every table, if that makes sense. That's what we had to tell them, isn't it? It may differ, but don't worry. It will differ on every table that I run it on. So everyone's on the same footing, basically. You know.
Yeah.
But I'm not a massive fan of Mothership, as you know.
But it's but that all works all very well, doesn't it? But the players, they see the inconsistencies, don't they?
And yeah, they do.
A lot of the time, they were pointing out the inconsistencies. And it's because the rules are written in such a way that it's all stripped down, isn't it? But yeah, there are one or two things that are open to interpretation. So even before the session, we all had slightly different take on what it actually meant.
There's a good game trying to get out of there, isn't there? It's a bit like you said, I think in another podcast earlier, it's one of those straight-back games that, in a way, possibly needs a little bit more in it, just to clarify one or two things that may, you know, kind of think make sense.
That's
the problem with it, I think.
Yeah. And the flowchart is deceptive because it seems like it should have a logic to it, but there's so many caveats built into that flowchart, it kind of renders it sort of useless in a way. And also there's like little rules buried away. What we've been doing is every so often we'd meet up, won't we, and just explain what we were doing, trying to get reassurance from each other that we were doing the right thing. You kept saying things like, well, you know, I'm going to give them extra bond points if they do such and such.
Resolve, and then, it's resolve, wasn't it? I'm going to give them
resolve, yeah.
Resolve points. And you said, what's that? What's that?
Yeah, resolve points, what is that? And there's one line that mentions resolve. Yeah. It's something that you can add when you're rolling on a fear tab.
And it was like, it's like first aid. There's a first aid skill, but I couldn't find or work out what first aid even does. It's like critical hits as well. Some weapons have an effect on critical hits and others don't. You think, right, I thought, does a critical do double damage? But then the effect, critical effect of some of the weapons, it says double damage. So you think, if you take a critical hit, you have to make a panic roll, don't you? But I thought, so if it doesn't have any effect, does the weapon do nothing extra on a critical apart from make you do a panic roll? I thought, I don't know. I wasn't sure, you know what I mean? It's not that it's a bad game. It's not a bad game. It's not that. I think sometimes just that perhaps it needs a few more words to describe and clarify one or two points. That's what I found with it.
You know, it has been kickstarted, hasn't it? A second edition has been kickstarted, hasn't it?
So yeah, which might,
maybe that'll
might, happen. Might, yeah, might kind of give it perhaps that little bit that it needs extra, I think, to just clarify one or two things. But it did work. You know, it did work.
Yeah.
You know, and in the essence, I suppose it is simple. It is a simple enough system, and I suppose it is a system. You, to its credit, I suppose you can play around with enough. There's enough movement in it to play around with the rules and make your own, as some of us did, our own little version of the rules for our encounter. I suppose it did have that going for it. It wasn't like one of those games where if you change one rule, everything falls apart. You know, it's you can do that with it. So it did work in the end.
Yeah. I do think it probably, in the end, worked out that it was the best experience that we've done of those multi-table events. Don't know how you feel.
Yeah.
You know,
it probably was. It was the most exhausting, but it did have a kind of kind of crazy party atmosphere to it, didn't really, I suppose.
Yeah.
Hey, sure, it's my round.
So following that, it's Grog Meet Eve, and I ran a game of Titan Effect, the Savage World setting that we covered in a couple of episodes ago, the one with espionage and low-level superpowers in a world where there's a global eugenics conspiracy. And it was taking the theme, because we had a bit of a theme, didn't we, around prog rock. Come over from the previous year. We weren't wedded to it, was it? It was kind of more of a prog flavour to some of the games that we were running. And I based this on Palace's album, The Sentinel, which was one of our favourites back in the day, wasn't it?
It was. I don't think I've listened to it since back in the day, to be honest with you. But there you go.
I would say that it's all right. It's all right. I think this particular album was popular with us because they're a bit like Marillion, weren't they? They're like long synth, rambling synths, noodling synth solos. They're probably a bit more poppy than Marillion, I'd say.
Yeah, I think so. Well, they only did the one album. They only did one album.
No. I think they're still going. I think they're still going. I think they've been in and out, but they have got other albums. Their other albums probably are a little different to The Sentinel, because The Sentinel, on the face of it, appears like a concept album, but it isn't really. There's just some thematic elements that are consistent in the stories. So for this scenario, I really just took the cover art, which is quite distinctive, and some of the key lyrics, and built some ideas around that. I didn't get too... I was concerned when you do a theme like that, you can't really go into deep into the lore of the albums because people don't know it, do they?
It's different. That is one of the difficulties, and we might talk about this when I talk about what I ran during Grogmeet. That is one of the problems. But the danger is you can slip into, is this clever? Is this really clever? But I'm referencing all the songs and the album and all the detail, but other people are either oblivious to it or, in a worst case scenario, confused because they're thinking, well, I don't really know this album. I don't know it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that would be true of me if I'd have played that game and you'd gone too much into the song and the album and all the minutiae of the album, and I hadn't listened to the album again, I'd be confused, even though I know the album, but I've not listened to it for years. So therefore, I'd just be as confused as anybody. You know, that's the danger, isn't it, with that kind of thing?
Yeah. So it's a new twist on the deep lore setting, isn't it? Like, forget about Glorantha. This is Palace the Sentinel.
Yeah.
There'll be people around the table, oh, well, actually, I think you'll find that Eyes in the Night is about returning after a gig. it was an infiltration and an elaborate seastead base. It was great fun, you know. It was like a Bond film. And the whole thing was built around doing this assassination of John Doe. And they got into this elaborate base codenamed Atlantis, seascape base. But I used all the bells and whistles of Savage Worlds, including the action cards and the adventure cards, should I say, and some quick encounters, montaging their way through, you know, where they're killing the guards and not getting too hung up on the minutiae of battle by battle, but getting to the finale. This horrendous figure, this criminal mastermind, when they faced him, you know what happened?
Go on.
They drew two jokers.
Did you shuffle the pack properly?
I did shuffle the pack properly, yeah. They drew two jokers, and Debbie had an adventure card that said that she could act as if she had a joker. So effectively, they had three jokers on the table, which meant that they acted first. And so they got a bead shot on his head, hit him. The damage exploded, and Mark pulled out of his back pocket an adventure card that said double damage. So he got hit with the first bullet they shot with 40 points of damage. So all my bennies were used up. That was the end of him. His head exploded like a watermelon. Oh, that's it then.
there's a weird disconnection, I think, sometimes between the player's experience and yours as games master, because you see, if I was playing that game, I would have really enjoyed all that, because as a player, you feel like you've got lucky, you've done something, got lucky and done something tactical with your adventure card so that you sort of win against the bad guy. As a games master, you have a different perspective where you think, I suppose it's almost like you sort of worry, have they enjoyed it? Because they made such short work. Have they enjoyed that? Or was it not exciting? But I think from a player's perspective, it is exciting because they are still rolling dice and playing cards and doing all the things that they do. You know, the fact that it goes their way doesn't perhaps bother a player as much as, you know, because it happened to me in Dungeon Crawl Classics at Expo, where I was the wizard, and there was this terrible monster at the end. And I just decided to spend 15, I had 15 strength and a spell burn. I went down to 1 strength and put 14 points into it, rolled the dice, added 14, and just absolutely annihilated it with a fireball spell that just completely wiped it out. But everyone enjoyed it and it was fun. And maybe with the games master thinking, oh, he's just killed me boss monster. Only one go. Yeah. But I don't think the player perception is the same. I didn't leave that Dungeon Crawl Classics game thinking, oh, well, that wasn't much of a monster. It didn't feel like that as a player. But as a games master, oh, I think that can be the case, can't it? You can think, oh no, I've a short change done by them not having a big fight. But I don't think players perceive it like that.
But fortunately, I had a setup where, you know, he was downed, but I had a device where he was experimenting with transhumanism. So he got into this, he was surrounded by these weird tanks and vats filled with strange creatures that he was developing. So he managed to get into one of those. But so the final fight was with this strange centaur creature. But to be fair, they made short work of that as well. But that's Savage Worlds for you, isn't it? That's Savage Worlds.
That is Savage Worlds, yeah.
Yeah. So it was great. It's great fun. I expended a lot of energy on the Friday. So when I came into Saturday, I played Star Frontiers in the morning and my voice was very croaky because the week before the con, last week, I had a really bad cold and I was just on the tail end of it. My voice was cracking in the morning. You forget, don't you, what a physical activity it is. You need to be at top of your game, really, like an athlete.
Yeah. Well, it's like those people, isn't it, when you come back from a convention, you say, well, you're tired, you're knackered. Well, what have you been doing playing games? You go, yeah, you don't understand now. It kind of takes a lot of mental energy. It's like you say, physical energy to some extent. Yeah.
Open box!
And so clearly you then got to the point where you thought, well, I could have a go at this. So
yeah,
how did that start?
I think that started quite early on. Like I say, when I realised, oh, well, there's loads of people online that are just making free games and putting them out, so it's like a Word document. I thought, well, obviously, I'll just make my own. It's going to be great. They weren't great. I like to revisit them occasionally to see, like, oh, was there any, like, secret stuff back there that I accidentally made that was really good? And there's not. But there, I remember starting to make one called Inheritance, which was kind of like a sort of ancient superheroes, like, 300 meets X-Men type thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember trying to do one that was like an urban espionage thing. But I don't know whether this is a strength or a weakness, but every time I read something, I always find something I don't like. And that one little thing will bug me, even if I like 90% of the system. And, you know, you can get around that with house rules. But a part of me always thinks, well, I could just start from scratch and make... You start with the house rules and then it kind of turns into, well, I'll just make my own little version of this. Mm-hmm. And then it'll grow and grow and grow. So I'm very good at starting these projects, and occasionally I finish them.
Yeah. And was Into the Odd the first one that you finished?
It was the first one that anyone seemed to enjoy. Right. I would say. And part of that, I think, is initially I just told people it was my D&D hack, which is a good way to get people to try your game. Because if you say, oh, do you want to try this RPG app design? People are like... But if you're like, oh, do you want to play D&D tonight? They might be like, yeah. And it's like, oh, well, we're running my D&D hack. It's slightly different, but don't worry.
Yeah.
And then when it's sat around the table, you can be like, so here's how it's different. And then you just explain the game. Yeah. So I always wonder how far I could go with that and just explain it. Sit down with Traveller or something and be like, yeah, we're playing this. My D&D hack. It's a completely different game.
so There'll be people out there who don't know Into the Odd.
Yes.
I think there's people in this room who probably don't know what Into the Odd is. So,
I suspect so.
Yeah, so just give us a pitch for how it works.
So Into the Odd, so the way it started, I should say, the Odd was kind of a slight little joke on OD&D. Because I kind of originally thought, the original concept was, could I just make like a really simplified strip back version of OD&D? Kind of like what Surgeon of the Unknown was doing, but could I steal that idea for myself and just make like my little version of it? And then it kind of grew out of that to become Into the Odd, which has some similarity still to D&D. So you'd recognize things like strength, dexterity, and willpower as your kind of stats. And you'd recognize things like HP, but that's kind of all of the rules there is. It's my attempt to kind of strip back as much as I can to have a very, very simple set of rules for doing that kind of low-level D&D stuff of going down into a dangerous place, messing around with weird magic items like immovable rods and, you know, portable holes, all those great magic items that don't need rules because you almost just need the name. Because that's like the pinnacle of design for me. if it works just off the name, it's great. So it's attempt to take all that and in a very simple set of rules and give it a kind of coat of a bit of a more your kind of industrial revolution kind of era with a bit of horror, a bit of sci-fi mixed in with all the fantasy stuff.
Yeah, and one of the key things for me about it is that it's kind of self-generating, isn't it? So
yes.
Yeah, so just to explain how that works.
Yeah, so it's kind of like I always like the idea that I like the idea of prepping your game so that when you sit down, you've almost got everything planned out that the players might do, which is obviously impossible. Yeah. But at least you've got something planned out so that you're not just making stuff up at the table and it doesn't feel like arbitrary. Like the players ask you a question and you're just like, yeah. I always like the idea that this is kind of almost pre-written before the players sit down. But I also wanted to accept the reality of not everyone wants to sit down and write hundreds of pages. Mm-hmm. So a good way around that, I always found, is random tables. So the back of the book is like a big chunk of random tables for generating sort of dungeon underground areas, generating the city of Bastion, where it's all kind of based around. Just lots of random tables allow you to get away with much less prep, in my experience. So, yeah, that's why that kind of, I hesitate to call it, emergent content. That's a good phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, emergent content.
Yeah, there's a lot of emergent content in this game, and I really did that on purpose.
Yeah. Excellent. And I know speaking to people about games that people have played and how people approach pre-generated characters, for example, and there is a lot of fun at generating characters at the table, and Into the Odd seems to promote that kind of.
Well, that's kind of the most fun that I ever had with Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, really, was just rolling characters.
Yeah.
Because that was almost more fun than the game, because you'd roll these characters and you'd get, you know, good scores here, bad scores there, and then you'd end up with a weird career. So I wanted to have some of that feel in Into the Odd, but also just a lot quicker. So you kind of roll your three stats down the line, 3d6 for each, which is quite swingy, so you do end up with people that just end up with a really duff character. But in my experience, that doesn't always necessarily mean they don't necessarily always have a bad time. They often end up having a better time because the people that end up with the good scores are the ones that often end up being overconfident and running ahead of the rest of the group, perhaps, or being the first to volunteer to go ahead. And the other slight little balancing thing in Into the Odd is the players who roll the lowest scores get slightly better starter package. So every player gets a little starter pack, which is three or four items. And the worse you roll on your scores, the better stuff you get. So you might end up with an Arcanum, which is kind of these strange magic items, or you might end up with a telepathic dog or a flamethrower, whereas the people who roll very well might end up with a club and a pigeon. Pigeon's good equipment. Maybe just a club.
Yeah.
That's doing that at the table, I always find like that's a good way of just, if I've got like new players, just getting them to start with that is like a really good way to sort of get them into the spirit of how the game's going to be, because you have to immediately start thinking, well, who is this character? And it gets the creativity juices flowing pretty quickly.
We should say, you said earlier, the arcana is just usually a single word or a couple of words, isn't it?
I always like these magic items, like I say, that are kind of like almost like plain speech. So you don't need to know about the system. So if you have a magic item that's like, oh, well, when you use this in a scene, you get a raise when you use your excitement score. Sometimes you read a magic item and you're like, this feels like it's part of the game. Whereas I like it to feel like something that you would see in a museum or on a weird old shop, like at the description underneath should kind of say what it does in plain terms. So yeah, a lot of them will do things like I always use the immovable rod as an example because it's one of my favorites. It's like you hold out this rod. This is obviously a D&D one. You hold it out, press the button, and then it's immovable. And there are so many stories people have got about things they've done with that that have, you know, in air quotes, broken the game. Yeah. But I would say that's made the game.
Yes.
Because you've got that story then. And I wanted to have a lot of things like that, yeah. So there's things like one of my favourites was I had one called a bone magnet, which is a magnet that attracts bones.
Yes.
But there was an actual play on a podcast where they used it in a very creative way and it made a great story, but they were basically using it to kind of snap necks. And it became, this is not necessarily what I had planned, which it's great and I'm glad it happened this once, but I don't want this to happen every time. So it is now the school magnet, which I guess you could still, but I've tweaked the description slightly, but now it's now a school magnet. And I also had to add that it doesn't apply to cartilage because there was another one where there was a big cartilageous giant that exists in an adventure. I now have to specify that. So I love these kind of items that create those kind of stories, and they almost kind of develop like a myth among people who've played the game. In the same way that people who play D&D, everyone's got the story about the portable hole or the decanter of endless water and things like that.
Yeah, and they are incredible. So how do you work through that? What's the process of like coming up with some of these things?
A part of it is just trying to think of things that would slightly break the game. So things that you wouldn't normally allow in a game. So I should say, there's Into the Odd, and the Electric Bastion Land was kind of my follow-up to that. And I had to write a lot more for that book because that was a much thicker book. And one of the processes that I did for coming up with lots of items for that book was to going on to like Screwfix website.
Yeah.
And just looking through tools and things like that. I mean, like, well, what would be the weird fantasy equivalent of this specific tool that's like a spirit level? So yeah. I think I can't remember what it's called, but there's something that's like a spirit level. And obviously, the obvious way to go with it is that it kind of like it's used to measure like someone's spirit, or like it's used to check for ghosts or something. So there's lots of, it just turns into lots of things like that where if you look close enough, you can see.
It's a Screwfix.
You can see the Screwfix website coming through.
Excellent. Yes, before we go on to Electric Bastion Land, let's stick with Into the Odd because I just talk about the publication history of that. So, because it kind of snowballed now and it's distributed by Free League. So, how did that come about?
So, I started writing it in 2011. And then, like I say, I was playing at the time, mostly playing kind of online games with, it was on Google Plus at the time. There was sort of a big community for playing games in Hangouts on Google Plus, which no longer exists. So from there and kind of tricking people into thinking they were playing D&D, it kind of picked up enough bit momentum that Paolo Greco from Lost Pages got in touch with me, who I knew anyway, sort of in sort of friendly terms online. Paolo got in touch with me and said, like, is this something you'd be interested in publishing through Lost Pages, who are kind of a small press publisher? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So we did that. And I still remember, like, the day that, like, we released it, thinking, like, oh, well, I'll be really glad if we sell, like, a few copies. If we sell out, like, if I can get into double figures in the first week, I felt like it wasn't a complete disaster. And it went to, like, double figures within the first, like, few hours, and then it wasn't, like, a gigantic seller. But for what I was expecting at the time, people seemed to really like it, and word seemed to be spreading in quite a good way. So from there, I was, you know, working a full-time job. So in my spare time, I started working on a follow-up. I was thinking, well, what should I do? Should I do like a supplement or like a standalone thing? And I'll go more into Electric Bastion Land afterwards. But after about 5 years of kind of messing around with it, Electric Bastion Land was born, which was kind of the big hardback follow-up. And that got a very good reception as well. But there were people who still said, you know, I like it, but I kind of miss the old Into the Odd being this very kind of slim little self-contained book. And it had a slightly different tone as well. And one or two things were slightly different. And I thought, well, now will be a really good opportunity to do like the definitive version of Into the Odd for people who still liked that original game. And I was already talking with Free League about some other things because I did a little bit of work for them. I did like a stretch goal for Forbidden Lands. I wrote a little dungeon for them. And when I was speaking with them about that, they mentioned that they like Into the Odd. And I thought they were being kind of polite. I'm like, oh yeah, we love your work. And I was like, okay. and I thought they were being polite. But then when I spoke to them again, that they mentioned, like, look, if you ever want to do a new edition, get in touch. And that's something we could talk about. So I sort of reopened the communications after that. And we decided to do a remastered version. So rather than doing like another new edition, if you like, I wanted to just do like the definitive version and just tidy up some wordings and add some extra stuff and more content without bloating it, but leave the kind of rules and the core of the game kind of untouched to how it was.
And the art direction in the new version is great. So
yeah, so that was Johan Noor, who people might know from Mottborg and Cyborg, the new sort of one. I'd already spoken with Johan, so I did a podcast with him shortly after Mottborg won all of the Ennies the year. This is the first year I was nominated for an Ennie, and I saw Mottborg was on there, and I'm like, I'm not going to win this because Mottborg are going to win everything. And I think they did win everything that they were up for. So we did a podcast with him afterwards, and I sort of made a joke like, if I ever want to stand a chance of winning an Ennie, I'm going to have to work with Johan. And then when this all came about, I thought, well, I would like to have, I always like books where you've got all of the visuals are kind of like, they look like a unified idea, books that use a single artist. I always think are really exciting. So I spoke to you and I said, look, would you be happy to do everything? Like, I'll give you the text, but then layout, graphic design, art, everything. Is that something you'd be interested in? And I thought he's going to be far too busy with other jobs. And he was very busy, but he was able to sort of shuffle some things around, and we managed to just squeeze him in. So he did the artwork for Into the Odd Remastered, and we didn't want it to look like Mottborg. That was like the first thing we both said. I was like, look, I really like Mottborg, and I really like the way it looks, but that's not how I want Into the Odd to look. Like, that's not the right look for this game. So we tried to get a balance of the text and the presentation of the text being almost quite straightforward and not quite plain, but very not Mottborg with like a million different typefaces and like big pink letters. Like, I wanted this kind of look like a book, like a real book you might find in a secondhand shop. And to go with that, we thought, well, what if we used a load of old public domain artwork, and kind of chewed it up and made it look weird, and gave it like weird color filters and like made weird collages out of it. So that it almost looked like when you find that old weird secondhand book and you almost can't work out what it is, and it's just got like diagrams and like photographs that look really strange. We wanted to kind of capture that kind of feel. So that's what he did, and I think it came out pretty good.
It's fantastic. And Electric Bastion Land has a different feel, but very distinctive feel.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about that. So how does this differ from Into the Odd?
So I wanted Electric Bastion Land. Originally, it was just going to be a supplement for Into the Odd. So it was going to be a load of extra character backgrounds, information about the world, guidance for running the game. But because the rules for Into the Odd kind of fit on one page, I thought, well, it'd be really, really cruel to not just include the rules in the book. Because it's like, for the sake of one page, I might as well just put the rules at the front. But when you do that, it's almost like you're creating another game, because now it becomes a self-contained thing. So I thought, I don't want this to be the replacement for Into the Odd. I wanted it to be like a different take on Into the Odd. And even after, so it's been out for 5 years now, I think. I still haven't quite worked out how to describe it, but it's a word that people use in like films is like a sidequel. It's not a sequel. It's like a different take on it. So that the main differences are, A, it's a much bigger book, which might sound like a strange thing to fixate on, but some people do really like that small format book of Into the Odd. But it moves the world forward. So Into the Odd is very industrial and kind of sort of 18th century-ish. But in my home games, I found I was using more stuff from kind of like more modern feeling stuff. So Electric Bastionland is kind of set more in the electric age. I spoke about those little starter packages that are in Into the Odd, where you get three items. I wanted to sort of explode those out to being more like the character backgrounds in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, where you have things like the rat catcher. That the fact that these rat catchers are significant people in this world tells you something about that world. I wanted to use that kind of idea, so there are 100 failed careers that your character can have. And my nod to the rat catcher is the squid bagger. So they have a squid catching pole and some variant on the small but vicious dog. They can have like a, I think there's like a large relaxed seagull. Is what I mean. It's always like two words and then an animal. So I did 100 of them. I sort of picked up a lot of kind of advice that I wanted to put in there for how to run a game like Into the Odd. So all that stuff is in there as well in the kind of the GM's guide section. So in spite of the fact that it's a big, you know, 330-odd page hardback book, I like to think it's got the largest stuff to rules ratio of any self-contained game, because the rules are still, you know, 1-2 pages. It's a different take on it, and the tone is slightly more. The tone is slightly more lighthearted, but it's kind of like lighthearted in still that kind of black humour kind of way, whereas Into the Odd is a little bit more played straight.
Yeah, that's what I found when I played Electric Bastionland. That it's very Gilliam-esque, isn't it? It's that kind of...
And almost like sort of the Ankh-Morpork, things like that were a big influence.
Yeah.
And that kind of... I mean, you see... I keep going back to Warhammer, but you see the kind of... You see that tension in all of the Warhammer settings between the kind of the comedy elements that were more prevalent kind of in the early editions are always slightly tense with the very serious elements of the setting. So this is my... I kind of had a similar thing with that in Into the Odd, whereas Electric Bastionland is by no means a comedy game, but I wanted to allow the slightly more light-hearted things to shine through a little bit in this one.
And it must be very rewarding to see it's influenced other games as well, isn't it? So some people have taken the mechanics of Into the Odd and...
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I think... Because, you know, pretty much every game I've ever written has started as me looking at someone else's game and thinking, here's what I'd change about that.
Yeah.
So it's like the natural cycle now that other people are taking this and doing something with it. But no, it's always really interesting to see what people come up with as well. It's very rewarding to see.
And so what are your plans going forward? Because... Yeah, are you still planning supplements for this, or what's your?
So my place with supplements is, I'm not very good at writing supplements. I think is what I've discovered over the last few years. I think I enjoy writing sort of supplemental material on my blog and sharing that around. But in terms of like writing a supplement book, it doesn't really appeal to me because I kind of want each book to be like its own self-contained thing.
Yeah.
So that you don't really need to buy anything else. The book kind of gives you what you need. So I'm definitely planning on doing something else in Bastionland. But the thing that I'm planning next would be like a self-contained thing that perhaps sits alongside it. But it is
another sidequel.
Yeah, another sidequel, to use that horrible word.
Yeah.
Something that you could put them alongside each other and share ideas. But if you just pick up one book, because that's the one you like the look of, you've kind of also got everything you need in there as well.
Yeah. So you talked about emerging content. So does that discourage you from producing like scenario ideas and scenario hooks?
Well,
like
I think that the boring answer is I just feel like I'm not... I have written sort of scenarios and adventure sites for Into the Odd Electric Bastionland, but I tend to just put them out as like a pay what you want PDF.
Yeah.
Because it's like if I'm planning a game at home, my notes are just an absolute mess and they're just... very brief.
I hear you.
Yeah, and I don't want to just put out those notes because that's kind of nonsense to anyone else. But I kind of want to be realistic about it. And when I've tidied them up enough that someone else could probably understand them, they're still not necessarily something that I feel would work as a book. So I tend to just put them out as they are.
It's really hard as well, isn't it? It's really hard.
I think writing an adventure for someone else to use is a completely different skill to like prepping an adventure. Yeah. For yourself. And I feel like I can prep decent games to run at home. But the idea of writing something for someone else to run is kind of it's a very different skill. And, you know, Into the Odd does have an adventure at the back, but even that is presented in a very kind of broad strokes way. And it's written in a way that it's almost like more like the sparks to get the game going rather than a sort of completely kind of comprehensive, here's everything you need. It still relies on the fact that the GM is going to be making some stuff up at the table, rolling on random tables and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing what you come up with. I'm going to ask people in the audience if they've got a question for Chris.
Reading
a legend
passing line, I wondered if you've ever read Angel House, he's in Viracodio, has that same kind of urban boldness to it.
I've not read that one. I recognise the title. That's about as far as I get with that. But a lot of people, whenever I've read like some reviews of Electric Bastion, people say, well, this is clearly inspired by... Perdido Street Station, is that? China Melville. And the other one is the film Brazil. All these references were coming up and I was like embarrassed because I was like, I've not actually read that. People think this is a reference to it. So I recently watched Brazil for the first time, the film, and I was like, this is exactly like how I was picturing it, but I've never seen this film. So I think what's happened is I've absorbed a lot of stuff secondhand. Because I'm very bad at finishing novels. Like I will start a lot of novels reading, but I'm really bad at finishing them. So yeah, I think a lot of those influences are kind of picked up secondhand through other things, and it's all just a kind of mess by the time it's made its way into my head.
Good.
One of the things I think is really distinctive about Electric Bastion Land is how integral I think the art is to the game as a whole, and you know, to really give you like the flavour of like Bastion Land. Was that conceived from the outset, or did that kind of evolve as you were sort of developing it?
Yeah, so the art in Electric Bastion Land was by Alex Sorensen, and he did all of the artwork, I think. Yes, all of the artwork, every single piece was by him. And because there was a bit of interesting development in the production of the book, the way it worked is the book was pretty much entirely written before Alec came on. And so I was able to send him the finished text. I always wanted it to have like a unified vision of like, this is one person's artwork all the way through it. But it was really fascinating seeing the pieces come in, because there's about 200 pieces of art, I think, in the book. And for the first few that came in, I'd be like, yeah, this is great, but, you know, feel free to do more of this if you want, or more of this. And then he'd keep getting a little bit more wild with it as the pieces would come in. And it's really interesting. You can almost see on some of them, oh, this was obviously a piece that came in quite early, because it's a little bit safer and a little bit more typical fantasy almost. And then if you see one that's got something really weird and strange in it, that's probably one that was later in development. So it was interesting because he was kind of discovering and working out the world as the pieces came in, and that's what I really like, because it's not just my vision of this world, it's his as well, as much as mine.
Thank you. Anybody else got a question?
So what's on the, what's your RPG bookshelf at home, what's on there?
I was joking about this recently. So I picked up some secondhand old books from some old bloke this week. What's happening is I'm finding that like I'm buying a lot more old books and selling more of my newer books to make space for them, because I have quite a limited shelf space in my little office at home. At the moment, things that are on my shelf that I'm actually reading at the moment. Funnily enough, I'm not just saying this, I genuinely did pick up the Prince Valiant storytelling game this weekend, secondhand. And games like that are very simple. I haven't read it yet, but I've skimmed through it and I know of it. I'm always interested in games like that are trying to present, that they're really trying to appeal to new people to the hobby. Mm-hmm. Even if you know that sort of veteran players are going to be playing as well, I'm always interested in how these games present themselves if they're anticipating getting new people. So I've got that one. I went to Warhammer World and picked up a reprint of the original Rogue Trader, which I've not read yet. That was like something I've been meaning to pick up for a long time. Reading through that has been really interesting recently. And what else is on my pile at the moment? I'll get there. This is being edited, right?
Yeah, it will be. Yeah.
Classic Traveller is another one that I picked up a couple of years, no, maybe last year, and I'm very interested in Classic Traveller and a lot of the sort of philosophy behind that. But like with everything, I love a lot of the ideas and the philosophy behind it, and there's certain bits about it that really annoy me in how it's written. But I think that's a sign of something that's going to stick with me. If it annoys me, there's something there.
Yeah,
it's better that than you just completely forget what you're looking at.
Good.
What would be the music playlist or soundtrack for Bastion Land or Into the Odds?
That's pressure now. So I wrote Into the Odd around the same time that I moved to Manchester. I'm not sure how much coincidence it is that I started to move it to sort of this industrial setting around the same time that I moved to, like, the industrial city, I guess. Even though it makes for quite a bleak soundtrack, I feel like Joy Division, some bits of Joy Division would fit with the kind of the sort of clanking industrial urban feel of parts of the setting. For Electric Bastion Land, I've heard a lot of people say that they like using... there's a group called Postmodern Jukebox who make kind of 1920s covers of sort of modern pop songs from like 80s through to now. And that kind of like the idea of it being the past, but it's like twisted, I think fits quite nicely with Electric Bastion and in the kind of hot jazz feel of some parts of it.
Okay, room for one more.
Your creative process, is it you get an idea and then create the world, or you have a world and then create the rules?
I think I don't often have the sense of like, well, I think I always start with kind of the nugget of like a vague idea of a setting, like, oh, I quite fancy writing a bit of a sci-fi game. It's very vague. But then I like the settings that I really like feel like they kind of emerge alongside the rules of the game and alongside the needs of the game. So the setting for Into the Odd and Electro Bastion Land, you know, kind of being the same setting, that setting grew out of what I actually needed at the table. So originally I had this whole thing where I was like, oh yeah, there's all these different regions of the world. But I sort of realized when I was playing, like, there kind of only needs to be one city, because either you're in the city or you're not. And if you make the city, that has some quite interesting connotations, because now all these ideas you had for different cities, like I originally had one where I was like, this is a city that's got lots of vaults with weird stuff in it. And this is a city there's been lots of alien interference in this city. And this one over here has lots of old decaying nobility, and this one over here has lots of industry, which is fine, but if you smash them all together, then that becomes a very interesting city with lots of possibilities. I like the settings that kind of grow out of the needs of the game. Not even so much the mechanics, I think that can be part of it, but just like what the game actually needs in terms of what does an adventure look like in this world, and what needs to exist to facilitate that kind of adventure.
Thank you. Thank you for really good questions from the Grog Squad. And really good answers, Chris. Really good, full answers. And the best I can say is that I'm really inspired to go away and play. And I really want to go away and play it. So can we thank Chris in the usual way? Thank you.
The Games Master continues to prepare.
So with the staff from Tears Game, I was playing Bugs in the System. I don't think I'm going to go too much into this because we're going to do a future episode on Star from Tears. Yeah. But I'm just going to make the point that it's the first time, I believe, that I put a full plan in front of people for them to explore this space station. Essentially, it was a dungeon in space. I forgot you put a plan on the table and they explore it. In a convention, you've not got time for that, have you?
The map of your enemy and all that, that is the problem with, and I've been caught out with that one a little bit when I did the Isle of Dread thing, virtual Grog Meet, you know, where there was a map and there was a dungeon, and it worked in the end, but I always worked because they took the right route, and I always remember that game thinking if they'd gone the other way, we'd never have finished it in time. Because how do I, once you've got a plan down, how can I eliminate a room for the sake of time? Yeah. I can't eliminate a room because it's there, isn't it? I mean, Roll 20, there's a black space where there is a room or a series of rooms, and you know there's something there. So what can I do? I can't do anything, can I? You're going to have to go with it. Yeah. 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 Jeez, it does trap you a bit, the convention.
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up, because they only ended up going down a corridor and going into the first room, I ended up the good old faithful 13 days montage to get them to the place where they needed to be. So that was good.
Although there is a plus side. There is a plus side to maps as well, I think, sometimes, in that when you put a map down and you have tokens and things, it can also sort of be a little bit more relaxing as for a games master, because it's there in front of the players. So it's there in front of them, isn't it, what they're dealing with in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas sometimes the old theatre of the mind, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier about the energy it takes, I think in some ways theatre of the mind requires more energy.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly keeping things in your head about where, so right, so we're in this room and what is there? There's this, there's that. Okay, right. Then they'll have discussions. Someone will go, so hang on, how many doors? There's two doors. Right, okay. Oh, sorry, I thought it was one. Oh, I thought there's three. You get all that going on. Whereas at least with a map, although you're right, it does trap you in terms of time. At least you look at it and go, that's what you've got. There it is. That's in front of you. That's what there is. Yeah, that's where the altar is. That's where the door is. That's where the well is. That's it. Yeah. So it can be a slightly more relaxing experience sometimes, I think, from a games master's point of view, when you have got a bit of a map. But I agree with the convention, it does. Yeah, you need to get trapped.
Yeah, you can't let the ending has to find them. They need to get to a conclusion. I relied on that montage. I think it worked well. It worked well because they got into the characters. I think that's why it took so long, because they enjoyed playing the Dralasites and the Yossarians and really got into the fun of Star Frontiers.
Yeah.
That was good. At the same time, you were running Vaesen?
Well, I played Vaesen on Friday night. Grogmeet Eve, I played Vaesen and I ran it on the morning of Grogmeet, and it is one of my favourite games. I think it's a really, really good game. I think I've said before, it was nice to play it because I've never played it before. Neil Hopkins ran it. Bermal Satsuma, I think, on Twitter, he ran one of the Seasons of Mystery stories. So I won't say too much about it in terms of plot. Because again, it's like a spoilers thing. Because I know everyone in the whole world backed the Mythic Britain Kickstarter, didn't they? You know, everyone's got a copy of that. I fully expect to see politicians, world leaders, experts, academics, all manner of people. I expect to see Mythic Britain Kickstarter book on the bookshelf when they're on Zoom calls to the news. I expect it to be there because clearly everyone in the world backed it, didn't they? You know, leaving you with the problem. Who can I run this for? Because everyone's got it. Everybody read it. If ever there's a case for Prime Directive, that is it, isn't it? But anyway, yeah. He ran one of the Seasons of Mystery adventures, which I have got, but I haven't read deliberately, really, just in case anyone offered to run one. So I hadn't read it. And that is a very atmospheric scenario where you go off to, you're sent off to a, you're invited to go to a party in Russia. So you end up on a coach trip across the Russian winter, across the Russian countryside, and you get caught in a blizzard. And you don't really get to the party. That's not a spoiler. You don't get to the party. That's a bit of a conceit. But you end up trapped in a Russian tavern in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by the snow. So there's no escape. You're stuck there with some strange characters. And it is an incredibly atmospheric game. There's just something about, I suppose, that period of history, that late Victorian period of history where people are modern enough, you're modern enough to be modern people, but it's not the modern world and it still has a sort of sense that it's in the past and it has an atmosphere and all that kind of supernatural stuff that's in Vaesen, you know, ghost stories and fairy folk and all those things sort of connect with that. So that I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed that. And I won't go into the plot because it's quite a clever plot. The plot is quite clever. So it's one of those, as a lot of Vaesen scenarios that where what you think's going on is not what's going on. And what you think might be the threat isn't really the threat. The threat is actually something completely different that's going to surprise you. But I enjoyed that. And
there's something about that year zero set of games. So Tales from the Loop really works well on that front, doesn't it, of having unexpected plot twists or unexpected avenues that you find yourself going down. It really lends itself to that, doesn't it? And I think it's cleverly the way that the game's constructed that allows that.
Yeah, you wonder whether like the city is the system. Yeah, the system itself is very. I mean, Vason is at the easier end of Free League. It's probably a little bit more complicated than Tales from the Loop, but not much more complicated. And I think that does help. Actually, it does help in terms of playing it and running it because it is very, very simple and it's very easy to. For players to improvise and come up with ideas, and for you as a games master to deal with those ideas, really, that simple dice pool mechanic is, yeah, it does work. It's almost like a game, and I mean the people who played my game on Saturday may differ, but I think it's a game where as a games master, and even as a player, you can't really fail to enjoy it. It's one of those kind of safety net games as a games master where you think it'll be all right this because people like it. People get into it. Something about the characters, you know, the whole setting and the archetypes that it uses, the whole thing. Somehow, even if the scenario was mediocre, never mind was. But you know, even though you feel if I put something together that's mediocre and it's not as good as I think it is or whatever, people will enjoy it because the setting, the characters, the whole shtick with the game. You know, and the simplicity of it as well. So you've never played it before. People pick up on it very quickly and work out what they've got to do. You know, it's not that difficult. All those factors mean you can't really fail with a game like that, can you? So on the Saturday morning, I ran my Squonk, based on the Genesis song, Squonk, Vason game. But I say based on Squonk. There was a Squonk in it, and the Squonk was the trigger for the problem that the village had. Which was that the fairy king in the forest had cursed the town because a hunter tried to catch the precious squonk. So the people in the town couldn't stop crying that and they called the society in to try and help. It was one of those adventures that involved trying to do a bargain with the fairy king. And again, I won't say too much because I may run it again, but there was kind of a bit of a trick in there where the fairy king wanted something. But there was a way of tricking him by fulfilling the bargain, but doing it in a tricksy way. And it was interesting because the players were divided about whether they felt they could trick him or whether they had to go through with his horrible demands. And that was entertaining. And again, players kind of engaged with it. And, it was really good.
In the afternoon, I was covering for a late... running my, this is counter May. This is my fourth game that I'm running here now. Oh, are you keeping up here? My fourth game, because we had a dropout at the last minute, so I covered it. But in the end, because of the number of dropouts that had taken place over the weekend due to this cold, I think, people getting the cold, amongst other things. I ended up with only two players, and it was OSE that I played, and I did Troubles at Ember Trees, scenario from White Dwarf 34. And we've talked about Troubles from Ember Trees before, an investigative game, one of probably the first investigative D&D White Dwarf games, to be fair, that involves the players investigating the poisoning of the employer. It's quite complicated, the actual plot and setup of Troubled Ember Tree, so I did some judicious editing of it. There is a dungeon in it, but different from the Star Frontiers dungeon, I was just editing it on the fly just to fit it, just so that they went to the key areas. It's written in a particularly... White Dwarf from the early 80s way, in that the resolution to the story, to the actual problem, you have to read through the adventure. I think we said this before. Those things where even as a games master, you're having to piece it together because of the way that it's, they've not told you what's actually going on. You have to read every single room entry to find it. All right, so that's what he's, that's where he is, and that's what he's doing. Okay. Yeah. So I had to, I simplified it to fit into the time that we had. Because really, the tools of them.
The old tradition from the 80s, of not telling you what's going on, like you said, just embedding it in the adventure. You realise that's why some of those old adventures were so confusing when you were a kid, because you read them and thought, and probably confusing now because you read them and thought, what's really going on here? I said, like, as a games master, I've got to work out what's going on as well. It's part of the challenge. I've got to work out what's going on before I run the damn thing. Yeah, can you just give me like a summary chapter like they do nowadays? A summary of, right, this is what's going on. And they, oh, right, it all falls into place. No, it's true that. And I remember back in the day reading old White Dwarf scenarios and things and thinking, what's going on here? What's this all about? I don't know what it's about, but you said they embedded it in the scenario. Don't explain it to me.
I had a really good time playing it because OSE is delightful to play, isn't it? Because it's so straightforward and easy to pick up. It's basic D&D, isn't it? And it's so infused with nostalgia. We did it at a nice, gentle pace. Because you know me, I'm usually pogoing around the bloody room, acting out what's going on.
And also, that I think with something like OSE, particularly OSE, that the expectations are laid down ahead of the game almost. So some games, people don't quite know what to expect. For an example, Call of Cthulhu, very popular game, but can take all sorts of forms. So you know what Call of Cthulhu is, but if you sign up to a con game, it could be all manner of things, couldn't it? It could be a subtle investigation. It could be cosmic horror. It could be this, that, and the other, you know. So, but OSE is a good thing about it is it is what it is, in as much as people know what to expect, and in fact sign up probably expecting expect what it gives. They expect, I would, if I signed up for an old school essentials game, I'd think, right, I will be possibly in a dungeon, I'll be fighting some monsters, I'd be very surprised, be astonished if I played an OSE game where I didn't fight some monsters, because that's what it is. You know, and that's is a games master again. It's almost like a no fail game because everyone around the table knows what they're getting, and you know what to give them. And they know
that at no point am I going to turn around and say, "Okay, tell me what's in this room." What are you experiencing? What does this thing look like? I get a lot of fun out of those games as well. You know, they're doing a bit of that with Titan Effect on the Friday night, but it's a different experience, isn't it? OSE, there's a pleasure in just doing that quite simple thing of resolving a fight.
I'm just thinking now of an old school adventure game played in a modern narrative way where, you know, you say, okay, you're the fighter, you're second level. You've killed a lot of people. How do you feel about that?
Yes.
What's the story? I mean, why did you become a fighter? Why not a cleric? You want to maybe share with the group, what's your character's background? What are the motivations? What really made you become a fighter? Why did you use a battle axe and not a longsword?
But it's no less inventive because the players are vulnerable because they've only got a few hit points. So they have to come up with some really good ideas of using the resources they've got. And the way that they resolve this return of this long-dead evil alchemist who was starting to emerge is to actually stick a ring on his petrified hand that was in another room and convert him to a frog god because they had this ring. And what a great end, you know, coming to declare evil, and he ended up ribbiting in the so it's no less inventive than those kind of narrative and story games in its way.
I would say it in some respects. And I think I said this when we did the Incandescent Grottos, Old School Essentials. We did that, didn't we, online with our Sunday group. I think it is possibly, and people don't quite see this, but I think it's possibly the most inventive form of role playing. And it's also the purest form of agency. In those, when we did Old School Essentials, did the Incandescent Grottos, what was fascinating was you were put down a dungeon, and it was a pre-written dungeon, and it was all laid out, and I knew what was behind all the doors, I knew what everything was. Some of those things even didn't make sense to me because they were a bit random. You know, here's a lever you can pull or not pull. Here's a door you can open or not open. You know, you open a door, there's someone trapped behind, a monster trapped who pleads with you. You can let him out, you can talk to him, you can shut the door, nail the door up, and do what you want. You have this kind of pure, there is a pure agency to a dungeon in a weird way. Because although you're trapped in a dungeon, you can go left or right. You can open this door and open that door and not deal with that. And whereas sometimes in other role-playing games, it's not quite like that, is it? You know, you get a feeling of, we've got to go and deal with that. But yeah, this is where the story's going. We've got to go and deal with that particular thing. Whereas in the dungeon, sometimes those random dungeons, you don't have to deal with things you don't want to deal with, and you can deal with things in a particular way. And as you said, the other flip side to it, the other element to it is because you're vulnerable, you are more creative as a player. And we've said this about like fifth edition, haven't we? Fifth edition, one of the criticisms of it is you have so many powers that all you do is just game it with your powers. You don't have to think inventively particularly. You can just go, right, I tell you what, I'm going to get 2 attacks per round against this guy. I'm going to do this. I've got an ability that can do that, blah, blah, blah. Whereas in those stripped back games, you haven't got as many abilities. So you have to think on your feet and think, can't really beat this guy in a straight fight. What are we going to do? You know, we've got a trick somewhere, you know. Yeah. And that is, in a way, is a purity to it, actually, that you lose sight of.
You know, my heart rate didn't increase at any point during that session. But it was pleasurable.
Yeah.
And before we move on to your game, indeed, I think because you were playing, weren't you? And I am going to recommend on Drive-Thru, it's called a Rogue's Gallery of OSE characters, so pre-generated characters. They're really good. You get some artwork with them, and there's a bit of background flavour to them as well. Quite inventive use of the character creation. So I'll put a link to them in the show notes.
Yeah, they're good, those, aren't they? I was surprised when I saw those. I thought, I've seen them. Some passing me by, but they are really very good, aren't they?
I had to get you to print them for me, didn't I? Because my printer was knackered, and that kind of it changed my grog meat, really, because obviously, before a grog meet, you're printing out loads of stuff. And I saw people were printing out loads of stuff. Because my printer was buggered, I wasn't able to do it. So I had to handmade make stuff or else get you to print it. I made a mistake, you see, because my printer stopped working. And it said, you need to refer it to an Epson engineer. And I went, no, I'm not in. To an engineer? Why? What's wrong? It was something.
How hard can it be?
How can I be? Something needed replacing, these pads that were in it that needed replacing. And so I went on YouTube, went on to eBay, bought the replacement part. How hard is it going to be? But they must have special tools for opening it.
You know why they have special tools? You know why they have special tools, don't
they? Yeah, because they don't want me to do it.
Because you have to call an engineer.
Almost
like it's rather wish racket, I had, isn't it?
Yeah. I rather wish I had, because I really messed up my printer. It's beyond repair. It's beyond repair now. I think even if we got an engineer to come and say,
is not that an example of where maybe Call of Cthulhu skill system is accurate? Because if you looked at a Call of Cthulhu skill sheet and it said repair printer 5%, you would say that's ridiculous. That is so ridiculously low. It's not that hard to repair a printer. It's not that hard. 5% is stupid. It should be at least 40%. Anyone can repair a printer. Come on. But clearly, it's 5%, isn't it? Is it 1%?
Yeah. And also, I don't tell my wife, there's a load of ink on the carpet as well, and I can't get it up.
What? Put something over it.
I have done.
Start a book stack.
I have done.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
So what were you playing in the afternoon?
In the afternoon, I played Troika, run by Debbie, Dragon Girl 74. I played that, Troika, which again, a bit of like racing on Friday night. I've run a few games of Troika, but I've never played it. So I like that, to get that experience as a player. And it was a scenario. Well, it was a scenario and a setting called Bones Deep, which is a Troika setting. It's a Troika system. But it's a setting where you play.
Yeah, because it stands alone, doesn't it? It's a standalone game, isn't it? You don't have to have Troika.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I'm not sure about that. I don't know whether you do need Troika. I don't know. I didn't look in. She had the book. She had the Troika robot, and she had the Bones Deep thing. But I don't know if you might need. Don't anyone listening, don't rush out and buy it. You might need Troika to play it. I don't know.
I don't think you do.
I'm not sure.
But again, there's a disclaimer involved. What's involved?
What's involved is it's like a lot of these Troika settings. It's a bit wacky, a bit zany, in that you play skeleton, you play the undead, as in you play skeletons on the seabed. They were once human, once alive, but are now reanimated. And one of the key things behind it is you've forgotten all your memories of being a human. So you have no memory of your human life or human objects. And the scenario was you had to go and salvage on behalf of some gangster crabs who you owed money to. You had to go and salvage a golden barge which had sunk to the bottom of the sea. So you had to go in and repair it, explore it, and deal with a few things that are in there and repair it, basically. But within that process, you discover things, but you don't know what they are. And I suppose it's kind of an interesting role-playing challenge to play it, because it challenges you to, as a player, you do know what these things are, but your skeleton, unless they make certain roles, won't know what things are. So you might find an object that, as a player, you think, you know, we find some lights and some wires. We know that they're wires and lights, but the skeletons don't, unless they make certain roles. When they touch these objects, they get memories of their previous life coming back to them. So you have to kind of role play it, as in, we all know what that is, but none of us make the role. Therefore, we don't know what it is. We have to pretend we don't know what that is, which is kind of interesting. And what I would say about Troika is, whilst it's advanced fighting fantasy, that's the system. So it's straightforward enough. And I suppose, you know, it's nothing special from that point of view, as in it's you do like an opposed roll for combat, like you're doing fighting fantasy, you roll two dice and try and roll under your skills. And you've got a luck. You've got a luck thing where you can burn luck. But that initiative system is fantastic in play. It is a really good initiative system where you put tokens in the back, and you know, each player has two tokens that go in the back, and there's an end of turn token that goes in the back, and the monsters have a certain number of tokens that go in the back. And what you do is you draw out the token, you draw out a token, and it might be a player, it might be a monster, but it could be the end of the turn, you know.
Yeah.
And at the end, it was a big fight with this kind of Hydra monster. And it was so much more exciting because of that initiative system, which is quick and it's quite tense, because you were kind of winning against this Hydra. So what happened, it was the classic, it's like a aquatic Hydra. You cut a head off. You cut all its heads off in one combat round. It was dead. If any heads were still going, the stumps grew two more heads. So you had to try and kill it in a round. But of course, with the Troika initiative system, that is quite, you don't know when the round's going to end, do you?
There
were moments where we thought, we've nearly got it. And it was, oh, it's the end of the round. And you're thinking, oh, no, you know, no. Because at one point, my character had a spell which made predators, you cast it on something, and predators would be drawn to it. So what I said was, and cast that on one of the heads. Does that mean the other heads attack that head? Debbie said, yeah, that's a good idea. It does. But I had to wait for my token to come out before I could cast it. So I'm waiting and waiting for the token to come out. So every time thinking, come on, come on, come on. Good for me. On my turn to do this, what I need to do. And then when I did that, cast that spell, it lasted for a turn. It lasted for the rest of the turn. So once I'd cast it, we were thinking, we don't want the end of the turn to come out. We don't want the end of the round to come out because that just negates everything I've done. So it worked, it does work really well as an initiative system. It's probably the only initiative system that I've encountered in a game that's quick and very exciting and unpredictable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes when people know their initiative order, people trying to play it tactically, don't they, and think, okay, well, I'll be going first. So what I'll do this. Yeah. I'm going first. So he can't get me. I'm going to get him before he gets me. Oh, I'm going last. So I'll tell you what, you lot do this and I'll go in last. So right at the end, I'll do. But in Troika, you don't know.
Yeah, I put thought to me that on Friday with Tyson Effect, because we're using Savage Worlds, somehow always used to get, I was getting 3 and 2.
Yeah.
So they were going first. So I didn't really land a blow on them because all the way through it, had the upper hand, which I suppose in that setting was all right because, you know, they're super competent spy agents. So maybe they would, you know, and they'd be faster than the guards. But it does remove some of the jeopardy if you are unlucky enough to always pull that out. But with Troika, it does mix it up a bit, doesn't it? Because if that thing is nobody knows, not even the Games Master knows
because a monster might get, say, 4 tokens, it can be monster, monster, monster. End of turn. New turn, monster. Because Gav was playing and Gav was like, I think he was quite shocked by it because he said, hang on, this means a monster could attack us and then it's the end of the turn and we don't act and then the monster attacks us again. Yeah, that is true. So the fight at the end was very tense because it all hinged on initiative. You know, all hinged on initiative. If the initiative had gone the wrong way, there was a point where we thought, we're all going to die here. In the end, we didn't. In the end, we didn't, but it was quite fascinating to play it that way and quite clever as well because, like I say, the monster at the end is very dependent on you killing it in one round, getting all the heads chopped off in one round. If anything was left at the end of the round, you were in more trouble. You were in even more trouble than you were at the beginning. So that fitted really well with the initiative system, you know, because it kind of complemented the excitement of it that you've got to deal with it. And it's the end of the round. We haven't dealt with it. Oh no. It's a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed it as a, you know, like I say, it's a quirky kind of setting, but it did work and it was a lot of fun. Good afternoon game as well. Sometimes with afternoon game, when you're a bit tired, you know, that lull in the afternoon, you want something that's fun, don't you? It's fun.
Yeah.
Intense. Yeah. It was intense in that it was exciting, but it was also fun. Lots of rolling on random tables and stuff like that. But actually, it's kind of, keep you engaged. You know, you there need some, in the afternoon.
There was some incredible, you know, just walking around taking pictures of the tables and the effort that the Games Masters had gone to. And like just sort of 100 people there. If you interviewed now people who went, they'd all have a different experience because people were playing different combinations of games. But it was incredible. And somebody came up to me and said, you know, the standard of the games is like nothing else that I've experienced before. And that's amazing, isn't it? That it feels like everybody is trying to up the game for Grogmeat, which has its tensions, doesn't it? Because I think I got the sense that a lot of people were quite anxious going into it in Games Masters, but ultimately it paid off.
It pays off, and I think what also pays off is that people do know each other. I think when we've talked about Expo, there's always that problem with bigger conventions, you know, and Owlbird's the same. Because people know each other, this probably may sound a bit cliquey, and I don't mean it to sound like that.
Because there are quite a lot of new people.
There are people who come who are new to it, so it's not as if it's, you know, like closed shop kind of situation. But yeah. I don't mean it like
there
that.
There are about 30 people who never attended before, so yeah. Go on.
No, but what I mean is, even for people who haven't attended before, there is a sort of community around it, even if it's just online, and people kind of know each other, or at least are on the same wavelength. I think that's part of it as well. There's a sort of wavelength thing, which makes games better, because everyone around the table kind of somehow intuitively knows what all this, the sort of level it's pitched at and where it's, you see what I mean? Whereas when we've been to Expo, you can sometimes sit down with people who are coming at it from a completely different, and I'm not saying their experience of role-playing or their taste in role-playing or the way they do it is wrong, but they can sometimes come at it from a very different perspective, and there's a bit of a clash. We've encountered that, haven't we, at Expo? Whereas I think there's far less risk of that with something like Grogmeet, because people are on the same wavelength.
And You're right, and we've talked to people through social media channel, either on the Discord or through Twitter, or whatever. I mean, that's worth the free blue tick in anybody's book, isn't it?
Come on, Elon, give us a blue tick. I don't know what's going on anymore.
I don't think he does. So that's all the games that we've played, but it's about the socialising and friendships. It's really good to see people really getting on, you know, getting on. I had some really good anecdotes, non-gaming anecdotes. Somebody standing on a stingray on a nudist beach in California. It's a story I won't forget because it came with pictures.
To be fair, on a nudist beach, it could have been a lot worse than standing on one, couldn't it? So,
You've got to be
grateful on a nudist beach. It was just your fault.
Yeah, can you take away the pain but keep the swelling? Anyway, there was loads of good stuff. Music recommendation, chats about different conventions, and the obligatory Doc Cowie and Gaz from the Smart Party talking about RuneQuest. It's almost like a ritual now. You've got to do it, haven't you?
It's got to be done, yeah.
The polarised debate has to continue, it will continue to be picked up. It's brilliant, it's rubbish, or it is both brilliant and rubbish. So that's it, that's another one over with, and thoughts turn to next year, whether we do one, what format that takes, and we'll go through the usual thing of saying, let's get the O2 arena, let's do it this way.
Yeah, bro, don't fix it.
So I just want to thank everybody who was part of it and made the journey to get there. Thank you for being part of it. Thank you to the Games Masters, both at Manchester and online, because virtual GrogMeet was taking place simultaneously. And so there were loads of people playing games there as well. So that was fantastic as well. So that's it. I'm going to go for a lie down now, Blythe. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I think I need it.
Oh, no. They sat in our chairs.
Thank you all for players and GMs coming to the GrogMeet. It's been a great weekend. I hope you all enjoyed it, and thanks for being part of it. Same again next year. Adios, amigos. Thank you very much.